So we've got our last presenter of the session, the last presenter of the
Thanks.
PowerPoint.
Thank you.
So this is John Bartlett from Deja.
Okay, good afternoon. Fitting in with the theme of the translating genre, I'm going to be looking particularly this afternoon at the some of the writing of American crime writer James Lee Burke, and how perhaps he attempts to do a sort of a translation of the Bible, really not only in theme and approach, but also perhaps to provide for a 21st century readership the sort of moral directions that we perhaps in the 21st century have lost, thanks to the failing of many of our institutions. So towards the end of James Lee Burke's most recent novel, Creole Bell, Dave Robichaux, his protagonist, there's a passage that epitomises, I think, the Cajun detective's longing for redemption, a sort of innate yearning to be released from the burden of the fall from grace that does haunt Burke's crime fiction. Robichaux listens to falling rain and he pines for a sort of biblical Noah's flood to wash clean the evil world that he sees around him. And he says, "I hope the rain would pour down during the entirety of the night and flood our property and clog the storm sewers and overflow the curbs and wash in waves through the streets and down the slopes of the Tesh until the oaks and cypresses and cane brakes along the bank seem to quiver inside the current. I wanted to see the rain wash clean all the surfaces of the earth as it did in Noah's time. That morning would bring a solitary dove flying towards the ship's bow with a green branch in its beak. I wanted to believe that biblical events of aeons ago would happen again." Now, Robichaux's biblical longings and fixations set him apart from another of other crime-fighting heroes, even though he also shares a number of their similarities too. Like Joe Nesbo's Harry Hole, Ian Rankin's Rabus, Henning Mankell's Wallander, he too is a wounded, damaged character, teetering on the edge of the law, but still striving for some sort of moral solidity. These are all characters that we can do identify with. But I wonder if perhaps contemporary readers are being drawn to crime fiction not purely for entertainment and escapism, but because they truly search, perhaps unconsciously or subconsciously, for a moral pathway in a society drifting rudderless in moral ambiguity. I think it's this double fascination that keeps us addicted to crime fiction. We identify with these seductive characters because they toy with the dark side of crime towards which they themselves often stray. And yet, as readers, we expect them to map out some sort of moral certainty for us as well. Now, certainly in the past 50 years, the traditional guardians of moral certainty, principally institutional religions, have tumbled from their exalted positions of the high moral ground. A series of ethical failures, particularly for the churches, institutional child abuse has almost totally discredited organised religion and rendered it incapable of providing moral guidance. This is an enormous loss for those who followed the Judeo-Christian tradition because they believe that was an ethical way of life. Now, church attendance may not necessarily be the only or infallible guide to religious belief, but it is one indicator. In 2004, a National Church Life Investigation in Australia surveyed 19 denominations and found that, quote, "declines in mainstream Anglican and Protestant denominations appear to have been offset by increases in attendance across the remaining Protestant and Pentecostal denominations. However, such increases have not been sufficient to counterbalance large continuing declines in Catholic attendance. Consequently, it's estimated that attendance fell by around 7% across participating denominations between 1996 and 2001. The decline for the Catholic Church was even higher at 13%. But despite this drift away from organised religion and the accompanying loss of rites of passage, people still struggle to live moral lives, and perhaps crime fiction provides hints at possible ethical directions. James Lee Burke, through his Cajun detective Dave Robichaux, is one of the most interesting and articulate high priests of this new religion. Burke's prose style is embedded in the language, symbols, and spirit of Christianity in the Bible. Robichaud enables Burke to rewrite some biblical ideas for a 21st century readership. As one of crime fiction's wounded heroes, he's also a messianic figure, trying to morally cleanse a fallen world. Robichaud has his own personal demons, struggling as he does with his horrific memories as a Vietnam vet and the challenges of being a dry alcoholic. Now, Alan Prigden in the 2002 Southern Quarterly suggests that Robichaud is a Christian hero striving for love, decency and self-sacrifice in the face of moral ambiguity all around him. However, his somewhat over-idealistic fixation on goodness is balanced by the character of Cleet Purcell, Robichaud's offsider, his symbiotic alter ego, who is a rampaging bundle of unpredictable badness. Of these two characters, Burke creates one identity, an idealistically burdened but vengeful Old Testament prophet, weighed down by responsibility for a fallen world and prepared to bludgeon a path for integrity. In an interview with Casey Cowers in July this year, Burke himself spoke about Robichaud's struggle with these two opposing forces. He's a dry alcoholic and, quote, "his alcoholism is always a presence, if perhaps only in the unconscious, but it's always there. He has those moments when he falls into seeming despair, periods of anger, rage and depression. It seems spiritual solutions work where other solutions for alcoholism do not," unquote. He's also grappling to maintain some sort of personal standard of ethics, despite the threat of being pulled down and destroyed by his demons. In Glass Rainbow, Robichaud says, quote, "if there's any human tragedy, there is only one, and it occurs when we forget who we are and remain silent while a stranger takes up residence inside our skin." Robichaud is portrayed by Burke as a Christ-like, redemptive figure, and there are a number of allusions to this role. In Elysian Fields, he accepts the fact that people like him, quote, "have to do life in the Garden of Gethsemane." Burke confirms his Christocentric illusion in an interview, saying that, quote, "Robichaud indicates that he believes that if he ever really involves himself in any cause, he's buying himself an admission ticket to the Garden of Gethsemane. He sweats blood," unquote. This is a reference to Jesus' pre-crucifixion agony in Gethsemane, when he supposedly sweated blood out of fear of his approaching death. Now, the Christian semi-messianic portrayal of Robichaud is further expanded by allusions to other Judeo-Christian symbols, including Francis of Assisi and the Everyman of medieval morality plays. Burke's fiction, I would think, reflects elements of 15th and 16th century morality plays, where our hero, to whom readers can presumably relate, undergoes a series of moral tests. Burke appears to be fascinated with the human value system, and maintains in that same interview that it originates somewhere in our DNA and goes way back to things we don't understand. Human beings, he says, all value the same qualities in their men and women, and the top of that list, the value list, is loyalty. Dave Robichaud and Cleet Purcell are really based on Chaucer's Good Knight, and they have all the qualities of the chivalric knights of the Arthurian legend, those who set out on the quest for the Holy Grail. Quote, "this quest for redemption," says Burke, "is all in ancient literature, and before there was literature, it was in ancient legend. All these things seem to be hardwired into the collective unconscious." This is what Carl Jung wrote about, and I subscribe to that same view, and that's what my books have been about. Every one of my books explores this same theme. Now, Dave Robichaud's lofty, quixotic battle against the forces of evil is balanced by Burke's creation of Cleet Purcell, Dave's battering ram of an outsider who is little bothered by staying on the right side of the law as long as he gets the bad guys. He has a reputation for violence and destruction and a penchant for driving around in his Cadillac like a reconstituted Moses of the Old Testament, descending righteously from Mount Sinai and breaking the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments over the head of some unsuspecting low-life criminal. He shows little conscience of his alter ego, Dave, who is more of a compassionate New Testament prophet. But Too much Robichaud earnestness would become unbearable and burdensome to readers, and so Purcell adds or supplies the gung-ho attitude that we need, that we're looking for. Barbara Bogue says that, quote, Cleet is not complete without Dave, and Dave is not complete without Cleet. They are symbiotic characters. Now, Robichaud must remain straight and sober in order for Purcell to play out his often wicked and unrestrained characteristics. According to Burke, Cleet plays Sancho Panza to Dave's idealistic Don Quixote, the idealist. Burke says that Cleet's the trickster out of medieval folk mythology, the guy who gets even for the rest of us. We love Francis of Assisi in retrospect, but when the going gets tough, we want Wyatt Earp on the job. Cleet nails the relationship clearly himself in Creole Bell when he says, look, the Bobsey twins for homicide are forever. These two characters, or one character with dual competing personalities if you prefer, wade into the apocalyptic landscape that is Louisiana, described by Robichaud as, quote, the great whore of Babylon, a direct biblical reference to the terminology of the New Testament's book of Revelation, chapter 17, verse 5, quote, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abomination of the earth. Burke's, and so Robichaud's, perception of the world as an evil place is rooted firmly in the Christian perception of the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, causing the entry of sin into the world. Innocence was compromised, and our world, according to these Christian principles, is still going through a process of Christ-initiated redemption. Robichaud feels his Christian responsibility deeply. New Iberia, Louisiana, is Robichaud's patch. Now, in 2005, as we know, it was scarred by Hurricane Katrina, and also by the neglect of those made homeless as a result of this event. Then followed the enormous damage caused by the Deepwater Horizon oil blowout in 2010, destroying both marine and wildlife habitats. Now, Burke and Robichaud both refused to use the word oil spill in relation to this disaster. For them, it's an oil blowout. In his book, A Stained White Innocence, Robichaud laments, over the years I'd seen all the dark players get to southern Louisiana in one form or another. The oil and chemical companies who drained and polluted the wetlands, the developers who could turn sugarcane acreage and pecan orchards into miles of tract homes and shopping malls that had the aesthetic qualities of the sewer works, and the mafia who operated out of New Orleans and brought in prostitution, slot machines, control of at least two big labour unions, and finally narcotics. The sins of the environmental and corporate criminals appear overwhelming for him. And Robichaud's sensitive moral antenna are also tuned to what he'd call historical sin, to the earth, for which for him still bears the wounds of past atrocities. In Last Card to Elysian Fields, he can still detect the horror of the Confederate dead from Shiloh and Port Hudson, when he reflects that, quote, Shiloh was not a grand moment in history, but a three-day meat cutter that soaked the hills with the blood of farm boys, most of whom never owned a slave or knew anything about the economics of northern textile mills. For Robichaud, the existence of evil is a mystery and has many forms. In Glass Rainbow, he reflects that, as with all sociopaths, the factual language used to describe their crimes said little, if anything, about their backgrounds or the influences that made them permanent members of the underclass. Maybe they grew up in shitholes. Maybe their fathers were violent drunks and their mothers wanted them aborted. Maybe they were crack babies, or they were born ugly, or poor, or stupid, or were poorly educated and denied access to a better life. But when you've seen the handiwork of their kind up close and personal, none of the aforementioned seems to offer an adequate explanation for their behaviours. Now, Burke himself describes Louisiana as, quote, an open-air mental asylum, a great place to live and write, but has the elements of mob rule that's really disturbing. He's also described Louisiana as, quote, a displaced South American port washed away in a storm and fixed to the southern rim of the United States. He believes, to quote, that the ExxonMobil flag should be placed on the Capitol dome because the state owns everything. Half the state is underwater and the other half is under indictment. Burke's prose style, peppered with biblical associations and religious motifs, provides the most convincing clue to his biblical preoccupations, repeated continuously like a chorus, reminding readers that the ground on which we are standing is sacred. In Last Card to Elysian Fields, Woodrow Reed says, quote, "The story of Judas ain't only in the Bible. 30 pieces of silver can come to you in lots of ways." In Creole Belle, Robichaud says, "I wanted to slip through the dimension into a place where moth and rust did not have their way, where thieves did not break in and steal. I felt sickened by my own life and the evil that seemed to pervade the earth," unquote. Now, this is practically a direct quote from the New Testament, Matthew chapter 6, verse 19, quote, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal." Also in Creole Belle, Robichaud reflects on his own fate, saying, "Who wants to be a prophet in his own country?" Paraphrasing Jesus in Luke chapter 4, verse 24, quote, "Assuredly, I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country." There are recurrent religious symbols in Burke's novels, keeping guard in the background like guardian angels over his prose. Countless times, characters pass by the grotto of the Mother of Jesus, silent like a sentry, reminding readers of a semi-divine presence. Another recurring image in the background of his stories is the raising and lowering of the drawbridge of the Bayou Tech, a waterway in southern Louisiana and part of the mighty Mississippi River. It's a constant reminder that Robichaud himself dwells somewhere in the twilight zone between an earthly and a heavenly world. He's a mystical figure who sees ghosts, has premonitions of his own death, often having visions of a riverboat full of departed souls coming to claim him and take him to the other side. The drawbridge is a reminder of his and our own morality, of his being not quite of this world. And towards the end of Creole Belle, his long-dead parents appear to warn him of a potential killer, as if he himself has already passed over to the other side. So, what conclusions can we make about the religious implications of Burke's Robichaud novels? James Lee Burke, I'd say, is an exponent of a new genre of crime fiction, which I'm christening redemptive fiction, a genre that suggests moral solutions to its readers. This is storytelling that, perhaps indirectly, provides answers to contemporary moral issues. Its dual purpose instructs as well as entertains. Now, this is not new in fiction. After all, in the end, Madame Bovary, as well as being fine literature, is an exploration of the moral effects of adultery, literary and instructive at the same time. But I'd argue too that there's nothing didactic or authoritarian about Burke's fiction. He's a fine prose stylist, not a preacher. His dialogue perfectly marries the authenticity of the Louisiana Badlands with the poetry of the King James Bible. As he himself says, "The sociological novel of the 1930s and 1940s has been replaced by the crime novel, although they're really one and the same, to look at society from the bottom up. Shakespeare did the same thing. We don't think of Shakespeare as a crime writer or the guys of the Old Testament as crime writers, but we'd be hard put to find a more bloody record of human experience outside these two sources." Now, we could argue that there's little nuance in Robichaud's understanding of good and evil. But most people, after all, just want their morality in black and white, of the biblical variety. In the Old Testament, there's little subtlety between what's good and what's evil, and that's exactly what we get in Burke. Ian Rankin admitted in a recent interview that his Rebus was, quote, "a bit of an Old Testament prophet, seeing morality in black and white." Perhaps then, there's been some sort of a religious virus recently infecting the protagonists of crime fiction. What's long been masquerading as crime fiction has already resurrected and rechristened itself. Crime fiction is dead. Long live redemptive fiction. Thank you. I don't have...
Speak well to an American audience.
Yes, yes.
I'm just wondering how he then goes over in the UK.
I don't have any sales figures, certainly, but I probably would imagine perhaps what you're hinting at, that he perhaps finds more of a resonance within America than perhaps outside. Yeah, perhaps doesn't translate so well elsewhere. Because along the lines we've been discussing today, his stories are very localised in that Louisiana landscape, and I guess would resonate most particularly with residents of that area particularly, yeah.
I was trying to think how to translate the title of Elysian Fields into French.
That wouldn't be so difficult.
I guess I'm wondering, thinking about the difference between this kind of fiction and, you know, other crime fiction, where the detective is often a messianic figure anyway, who's reacting against a disruption or disturbance in society to try to bring back to order, and who, in most cases, carries values at the same time. While at the same time being sometimes a degenerate character and an alcoholic as opposed to a reformed alcoholic. So I'm just trying to, there's some kind of continuity here in, as well as that kind of different sort of discourse that's wrapped around it.
I would certainly agree that the many other sort of protagonists of crime fiction that have that same sort of messianic sort of self-belief perhaps in themselves. I suppose the thing that seemed to me the difference with Burke is that he's so specifically religious, and I mean he's a Catholic himself, you know, he comes out of that, he writes very much out of that strong sort of religious background, I would say probably even a practicing Catholic. So he has a very sort of Christocentric biblical sort of approach, but it makes him perhaps a bit different to some of the other protagonists that have that same messianic feeling, but for other reasons. But the end result, I guess, is the same. It's that sort of idea of perhaps bringing some change to society and putting things right in some way or another, despite the fact that they're not quite sure, you know, how to make their own selves right, even.
Yeah, I think Burke's fantastic prose style. John Forbes Park described as macho lyricism. You know, it's the sentence on hung like a fried egg above the ash of fly swamp land, the smell of breeze coming in from the Gulf of Mexico carried with it the faint distant smell of machine oil like up on the decks when my pappy was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know. Certainly that kind of, you know, drives forward a kind of morality in itself, because he's clearly drawing on, you know, a preacher kind of style. But it's a strange kind of religiosity, because it's Catholic, but it's sort of infused with American evangelical Protestantism as well as a, you know, so in his kind of personal morality. You know, it is slightly religiously confusing. He's very rarely trotting off to confession. He does occasionally, but the other thing I think that gives a kind of authority to what he to the voice is that although Dave Robichaux is the first person narrator, James Lee Burke actually cheats on this, and if you look very carefully, it's fantastic. He's got cards up his sleeve. Dave Robichaux knows things that no first-person narrator could possibly know about his characters. You know, Billy Bob was conceived on the backseat of a Model T. The smell of the leather coming up through his father's nostrils at the moment of climax as he cried out, "What the fuck?" You know, how do you know that? And he slips these in, which give this tremendous kind of authority, because he has both the intimacy of the first person narrator, so he's kind of saying there is evil in the world, and you know. But at the same time, he uses these kind of omniscient tricks when he likes. So it gives a great kind of power to his work. It's like he's got a kind of secret into people's minds. And unless you, part of his skillful technique as a writer is that you have to look very carefully for these, and you don't actually see very often that he's palmed the cards. But I agree with you. I think there's a tremendous kind of a sort of thundering, you know, tone of the preacher in this prose that's very, very appealing.
Yes, he has that. I'm glad you mentioned his prose style. And he has that sort of incredible sense of self-belief that can be irritating, I think, sometimes, except it's the prose style and his control of the text that you're sort of forgiving for. And sometimes perhaps you can be a bit pissed off with his sense of what's right and what's wrong, because, you know, it's never really ever that clear. But, you know, it's that dominance, I suppose, that you're talking about, his control of the text and of knowing everything that's happening and pulling everything together, that you sort of forgive him perhaps being quite so black and white.
Ghost. I mean, give me a break.
That's right.
There's an element of the Southern Gothic.
He
can't keep himself away from.
That's right. Yes. Thanks for that, Jen.
But it's also incredibly Southern. I mean, this is where you go down back roads and whatever, and you'll get a bottle that says alcohol, and then you'll have skull and crossbones and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it really fits the Louisiana kind of, in terms of place, it actually, I would imagine lots of people in Louisiana who read actually would, in fact, relate to this, because there are characters like that almost in every little town of Louisiana, Mississippi.
And it's incredibly seductive, I think, the characters that he presents and the dialogue, and you can't quite believe that, you know, they say what they say. It's so funny and, you know, so wise and just so entertaining. And I suppose that's what you're forgiving for all the time, because he just drags you along in that entertaining, beautiful prose style.
And he's so good on race.
Yes, yes. Yes, all those sort of deeper issues, you know, he doesn't shove them in your face, but they're there in the background, sort of remind you of what's happening, the issues, the cultural stuff, social stuff.
Just back to the didactic thing, and going what we were talking about before, I've been trying to write a detective, a police detective, who, well, a fairly competent detective, an atrocious human being, and it's really kind of hard to escape this bad human being who is essentially still good, if that makes sense. It's really hard for me to kind of escape that, and I just wonder, does that lend to that being a didactic? Fiction, if detectives are always inherently good, does that not make the novel that they occupy
didactic? Well, I people who sort of write crime fiction, would answer better, but it seems to me that to have a protagonist that's good is totally, you know, boring, that unless you've got a protagonist that's part of the struggle too, and they're, you know, they're wounded and broken and, you know, trying to do the right thing, it's not a very interesting story. Others might be able to comment perhaps on that. So maybe the more of a mixed up character they are, the more interesting the story is. I don't know, Shane, perhaps you could say something about that.
No? I agree with you.
We don't want our protagonists to be too pure, do we?
Yeah. I think that you can have protagonists that does very, very bad things that we don't particularly like, as long as we can understand why they're doing them. Mm. We can put ourselves in their shoes and say, well, I can understand why they're doing it to their family, etc. Think of someone like Big Maggie from The Shield, who starts out, you know, in the opening scenes of the first series, where he's spoiling it, shooting his partner, and then goes on, yet we still like him because he's doing it for the good of his family.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think you have an overarching sense of purpose and motivation that we can relate to if we're in his shoes.
And I think that's the attraction of something like crime fiction, as opposed to the sort of moralising you get from institutions that sort of say, you know, this is the good thing and this is the bad thing, but we know that life's never like that. life is about, you know, making mistakes and stuffing up and yet still perhaps, you know, trying to find a way through it all. And I think that's one of the attractions that of crime fiction. What I'm suggesting is maybe why it's so attractive to us at the moment, because the institutions have sort of pretty much stuffed up and let us down.
Sounds like a good place to stop.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's another paper, Phil, who's asked for the interview. Thank you.
If anyone is not familiar with Wollongong and they're going down Hall Mire,